The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Premier League, another goodbye present from David Silver, means Bournemouth have it all to do to survive. We'll look at the remaining fixtures and make some bold predictions that we'll pretend never happened in a couple of weeks. Elsewhere, Van Dijk goes full Louise at the Emirates. There's late penalty drama at Burnley and Harry Kane gets some more goals. In the Championship, Wigan score 7 in the first half, all accompanied by the same goal music, while Brentford keep pushing Leeds and West Brom at the top. We'll discuss the racism against Heung-min Son and James McLean. We'll talk football Twitter accounts and we'll finish with a riddle. All that plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. Now, before I introduce the panel, just so you know, my microphone decided to stop working during part one. So for part one, the audio quality from me will be poor, but the quality of the podcast will be high. Then in part two, my microphone quality will get back to normal. Thanks for listening.
On the panel today, Johnny Liu, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Fine, yeah. Sorry I'm slightly late. Had to deal with a messy nappy, but all good now. It wasn't mine, I hasten to add.
No, that's good to know. Flo Lloyd-Hughes, how are you?
I'm all right, a little bit sleepy. I've had in case of insomnia last couple of weeks.
Oh, so.
Yeah, not enough coffee to try and solve that one.
I think jigsaw puzzles apparently are meant to be good. If you can't sleep, then you go downstairs and you do a jigsaw puzzle for a bit, because it's not it doesn't affect the brain so much like reading that you sort of start thinking about the book, but it affects it enough to make it tired.
Okay. I tried to get some jigsaws during lockdown and I just couldn't find any good ones online. But now the charity shops are open, that's normally a good place to find jigsaws. So,
I mean, what defines a good one is a difficult question.
Well, the only one I could find was like a, you know, 20-piece Toy Story one, which should probably more suited to Jonathan's child than me. So, yeah, I don't think that's going to make me sleepy.
Paul McInnes, welcome to the pod.
Hello, Max.
We haven't seen you since lockdown, and although this doesn't matter to any listeners, we can't see you now because your phone is pointing towards your skylight. But it's nice to have you on, and how has lockdown been?
It's been absolutely miserable, as you might expect. I mean, what are the prospects of going down and doing a jigsaw in the middle of the night when your brain is absolutely obsessed with a global pandemic? Does it sort of put it to one side, do you think? Sort of the snapping of pieces of cardboard?
Well, I'm quite a simple soul, so I think it would for me, but everybody's different.
Everybody's different. Yeah, I worry too much. But yeah, I'm generally, actually, I'm fine. Thank you very much for asking.
Maybe we should release Football Weekly puzzles with all the panellists in like a sort of Where's Wally. That would be some good merch. Whoever does that sort of thing, can they organise that, please? Right, let's start at the Etihad then. Man City 2, Bournemouth 1. I want to talk about the relegation battle. But first of all, the question from Guy: has any retiring Premier League footballer deserved the cheers of the crowd more than David Silver? Will any retiring Premier League footballer ever retire in such silence? Has there ever been a greater shame, Johnny?
Yeah, I mean, it was some farewell, wasn't it? It's some farewell tour. Yeah, I mean, I think he's possibly City's greatest ever overseas player. I've certainly seen that view bandied about. And you know, in terms of the crowd, I mean, he's actually one of those players that I've always felt is like best appreciated in total silence. He's not somebody that gets you off your feet or anything. He's somebody that you just sit there and go, yeah, that was really good. Oh, I didn't see that pass. It's almost kind of like an intellectual exercise watching David Silver. So if you watch a kind of a highlights reel of him, if you pause the video at exactly the right time, You try and spot the pass that he's about to play. You can play a similar game with Messi as well, actually. So yeah, I mean, I think in many ways, playing out the final days of his English football career in total silence is actually quite fitting.
He's quite understated in a way. I mean, that might sound ridiculous given how many brilliant things he's done.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's for a long time. It took ages to work out actually how good he was. For people to notice. I mean, Yaya Toure got a lot of the headlines, Balotelli, Aguero. Yeah, he kind of slipped in under the radar for at least a couple of seasons.
Where do you put him, Flo? All those kind of lists you can have: greatest Man City player, greatest foreign player, greatest player, greatest short player, whatever.
I think he's definitely one of the best players to ever play in the Premier League, for sure. And I think you're right. I think he is understated. He's not got a massive personality, and we tend to focus on the players that do. He's also quite a small player, quite a slight player, so that probably doesn't help. And he's not a very flashy guy either. He doesn't do a ton of endorsement deals, I don't think in Spain anyway, and obviously not here really. And he's not ever really been someone that City wheel out for a lot of media and a lot of interviews. He obviously had a kind of really horrible time personally a couple of years ago when he took a bit of time off, and the club really rallied around him and the fans too. But I think he's definitely, yeah, one of the best players who are playing in the Premier League. It's just so beautiful to watch. So he just plays with such ease. And yeah, it's a joy to watch, and I'll be sad when he leaves.
I really hope, given what you said about endorsements, that he just has, like Bill Murray in Lost in Translation, it's like just loads of deals in random countries that we know nothing about. There's just hordes and hordes of him advertising fish oil and...
I know, I'm probably going to get sent a bunch of YouTube clips of him selling lip balm in Spain. So wait till we see that. But
and actually, Paul, I mean, one of the greatest skills of Premier League footballers is taking the ball in confined areas and being so technically gifted with it. And I can't think of a better exponent of that.
I think that's a really good point, because I think there's two things about Silva when he came to City. Was, you know, He wasn't an undeveloped prospect. He'd been a success in La Liga at Valencia, but he was still young. So for City to sign that kind of player, I think, was a statement for them as a club, but also for the style of play. And you're exactly right. That sort of player who knits the play together in that final third is not somebody that the English game has traditionally been built around. You know, if you think about the Fergie teams, even the Mourinho teams, they didn't really use that type of player. It was about getting the ball wide, getting the crosses in. So yeah, I think he's sort of a really symbolic figure in the change of not just the sort of balance of power in English football, but also the style of play as well. Just quickly onto your point as silent retirement, I do recall Michael Owen's final game playing for Stoke, which I think was the same day as Gerrard retired, and there were other people retiring, and match of the day was going around from ground to ground with people getting emotional send-offs, and Stoke was just half empty and silent for Michael Owen, which I think was a bit poignant, really.
Yeah, it was a few weeks ago that it was the, you know, in lockdown there were a lot more notice of anniversaries because there was no football actually being played, and it was, you know, so many years, 22 years it would have been since Owen v Argentina. And it's just worth watching that goal over and over again for just pace, youth, exuberance, not passing to Paul Scholes. It's all of it is absolutely brilliant. Johnny, do you want to relegate Bournemouth now, or do you still give them hope? You've got Villa 30 from 35, Bournemouth 31 points from 36, Watford and West Ham both 34 points from 35.
Well, I mean, the crucial thing is Watford and West Ham play on Friday night, which... I don't know if there's been a bigger game in terms of relegation, you know, relegation six pointers this season yet. So, you know, that will be the hope that whoever loses that game will end up kind of, you know, slipping into the mire. And in fact, there were lots of positive signs for Bournemouth. I know sort of 36 games into the season is a little bit late in the day to be starting taking the positives from a performance. But, you know, they were actually very decent for most of the game. They probably should have got something from it. And that's probably the, you know, the thing that they're going to cling on to, that, you know, the arse isn't falling out of them, you know, in the way that it is with a lot of size down there. I think that they'll still cling to that sort of faint vestige of hope and I guess hope for a favour from somewhere else.
So you mentioned that West Ham Watford, it's a massive game on Friday, isn't it? Villa go to Everton tonight, and then Villa have Arsenal and West Ham. Bournemouth have Southampton and Everton. Watford have City and Arsenal. So that does put even more importance on that West Ham game for Watford, doesn't it? And West Ham then play Manchester United, and then they've got Villa. Who's more important to stay in the Premier League? I sort of feel that West Ham need to be there and be shit in it for it to feel like the Premier League is the Premier League, Paul.
What?
does that not make sense to you?
That's absolute madness, man. I you know, I kind of feel like, you know, West Ham have not been down in recent memory, and they sort of You know, they used that to have a Sam Allardyce reset. So that was comedy. Mm. Watford are a side that have, you know, almost Wolves like to being kind of rather find it rather easy to stay up in seasons gone by, and that, you know, that you look at the squad on from a particular angle and it's very workmanlike. It doesn't have much in the way of quality. And then on another day, you kind of think, well, Will Hughes can play the ball. Etienne Capoue is a great midfield destroyer. Enforcer Doucouré is a uncategorizable player. You've got Saar, you've got Deeney, Dawson from free kicks. They've got a lot of options. I think those two teams are going to stay up. I think they're always going to be staying up. It was always going to be that way. I think the bottom three has largely played as if it's been doomed for some time. And I think Bournemouth's next game, Southampton at home, that I think they need a win there. Southampton probably the form team in the league at the moment. If they don't get that, it's going to be an awful lot of pressure for them. So I think I could see West Ham and Watford thinking, well, just a point apiece will be fine for both of us.
Oh, does that mean we could have a kind of, what was the one in 82? It was the
Anschluss.
The Anschluss of Gijón, was it? Or something like that?
Yeah.
I've talked about it. I mean, we talked about it in detail, I'd say less than a month ago.
that's lockdown.
Yeah, but we could have Watford and West Ham just passing it Simpsons football-like between each other and just playing out a goalless draw. Flo, do you agree with Paul? I mean, it does tend to look like now that it's Villa and Bournemouth that are gone.
Yeah, I think Villa are definitely in trouble because they haven't shown the fight that Bournemouth have, and Bournemouth are still scoring goals. I mean, it must be really frustrating to be a Bournemouth fan because they performed so well against some of the big clubs, you know, City and United especially, and just haven't made the most of their chances or just completely collapsed at the back, Man United game being a prime example. I think Watford could be in trouble because they've got to play Man City and Arsenal still. So if Bournemouth can get their results and hope that Watford struggle against those teams, then I think I'm hopeful for Bournemouth. That's the only thing. And I think Watford have been looking so lost recently and got some surprising results, but all in all just don't play well, whereas Bournemouth actually play well at times, that I'm more hopeful of Bournemouth surviving given their fixtures than Watford, who have to play West Ham, who are also fighting Man City and Arsenal. Now, obviously, Arsenal are extremely inconsistent and it depends what Arsenal are going to turn up on the day. But what I haven't seen that fight from Watford that, you know, we've seen from Bournemouth at the moment and Southampton, who've just gone on an amazing run and have performed so well in this second half of the season. So, yeah, I'm more worried for Watford than Bournemouth.
We'll look ahead to Manchester City's FA Cup semi with Arsenal after we talk about Arsenal's win over Liverpool 2-1. Liverpool can't get 100 points now. Paul, does that matter?
Yeah, I think it does, you know. You know, it's an amazing achievement, but that's 2 weeks ago's news, I guess, the title. And I'm sure Klopp will have looked at this, the restart, and think, well, that was it, the Crystal Palace game, they tonked them. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, it's been quite workmanlike and quite a struggle. It was very un-Liverpool-like, the defeat. Two, you know, absolute clangers of errors from their most reliable defensive mainstays. But at the same time, I think they probably really wanted to put the cherry on this season and say, yeah. Because all the tributes that came out when they won the league was, this is an exceptional side. This is a side for the ages. And, you know, and there was always a bit of reservation with the City Centurions, like, can they do it again? You know, they have to sort of keep making, they have to build an epoch. And I think, well, you know, Liverpool haven't matched that City side. So there probably will be a slight sour, I imagine, in Klopp's mouth, certainly.
Barney Ronay tweeting, it's so alpha of Van Dijk to come to David Luiz's home patch and do what he does, but even better. And actually on Sky in the UK, you know, Graham Souness and Sol Campbell, who were the pundits, who have both, you know, played games after winning the league, just said, it is hard, right, to just, even if you say all the right things and you do all the right things, if you don't really need to win, you don't really need to win. Like there's nothing you can do about that.
Yeah, I mean that is true. I just think, you know, that there was a chance to go for history, and I'm sure that is a motivation in and of itself, whether it's the ultimate vital motivation. But you know, Arsenal didn't have to win. after the Spurs defeat, the European qualification was looking at, you know, it's not, they're going to have to go some. So, yeah, I don't know. I think they will be disappointed.
It matters in the sense of, for like online bragging rights. It matters only in the sense of being able to have an online discussion, which is actually is kind of all football is these days. It's like a serial sort of Twitter message board, Reddit, you know, one-upmanship, and this kind of stuff. It does matter for that, but it does also kind of, it shows where, you know, where football is at in terms of, you know, when Leicester won the league, I think it was 81 points they won the league with. And now we're serially talking about 97, 98, 100 points. And if you don't breach 100 points, then somehow you've kind of fallen short, which I think just says a little bit about how much the league has stretched out over the last few years.
But that's exactly what it is, because City Twitter admin was bloody waiting to press the 100 emoji button as soon as that result came through. It's probably sitting in their draft for weeks. So it's exactly what it is. It's just become kind of social media one-upmanship, cringe stuff. But I mean, if I was a City fan, I would probably be basking in that glory as well. So fair enough.
Should mention Martinez. He made a wonderful save from Trent Alexander-Arnold at the end of that. And he's played really well since coming in for Bernd Leno. Question from Jim. Will Liverpool add to their squad, and who would fit in? Johnny?
Well, this is the £64 million question, isn't it? It is such a finely tuned ecosystem, this Liverpool team, that it's kind of the same problem that Pochettino's Tottenham had when you know, they were getting dogs abused for not signing anyone two or three summers ago. That the players that would fit into that system and that would genuinely improve it are really kind of really few and far between. There was a lot of talk of Timo Werner, who, you know, for I guess financial reasons and economic reasons, didn't make the move at that time, and Chelsea kind of snuck in. But short of like a wholesale refresh, it's hard to see how, you know, where the individual players are that would improve that team. Maybe you could make an upgraded midfield, or you know, maybe you could sort of start succession planning for when I think Salah and Firmino and Mane are all in their late 20s. So, but I mean, it's really hard to do that in practice. You know, Minamino, you know, we saw a bit of him last night. He's shown flashes of promise, but is he kind of ready to take one of those three forward slots, and who is he going to replace? I think that's the big problem. There are conceivably players out there that could improve them, but whether they would practically come to Liverpool, whether they'd be affordable, and whether they'd actually replace any of the current players in the team right now, that's the harder issue for them.
Just on Minamino, yeah, I thought he looked really enticing last night, because he looked Todd Cantwell like. I was quite buzzing off of him. But I think I would say sell Mane, get Mbappe to the same team, do a deal with PSG, get Mbappe, and that would be a sort of a next level buzz around the club. You'd regenerate the forward line. A kid who would absolutely thrive on playing under Klopp. I think that would be the sort of, if I was going to go for a fantasista signing, that's what I'd say.
It would be great. I mean, it would be depressing for the rest of the Premier League, but it would be great to see him there, wouldn't it? Joe says, does the panel now suspect, as I do, that Jerdan Shaqiri didn't make an appearance for Liverpool between January the 11th and July the 15th because he was secretly serving a prison sentence for the theft of another man's hair? When Shaqiri came on, and I was like, maybe this is... Is this his natural hair colour? Has he been lying to us for the rest of time? And then somebody sent me some photos saying that Shaqiri has been rethatched, I think. And credit to any footballer who gets rethatched during a season. Tricky with the lockdown. I think Ashley Barnes did it last year just during the season, which is highly commendable. Now, Arsenal play Man City in the FA Cup semi-final. That's Saturday, 7:45. Does anybody give Arsenal a hope? Flo, can you give Arsenal hope for this one? It's a one-off game. It's very much like a cup final, except almost like a cup final, but the one before the cup final.
I mean, Arsenal are just so unpredictable. You just don't know who's going to turn up. I give them hope, maybe like a 4 out of 10. I think last night they were lucky because... Yeah, Liverpool have sort of run out of gas. We talked about the motivation to get to 100, and is that really enough for them right now? I think that game's going to be a lot different. Having watched the playoff finals at Wembley so far, play in that vacuous space where there's no energy to feed off, it's really hard to work out where the players kind of get that energy when they're just looking at 8,000 empty seats. And we've seen some kind of real dominant performances in some of the playoff games there. So pretty one-sided situation. So, I have no idea.
I mean, I give Arsenal a hope. I think we saw signs from them last night, sort of against Liverpool, that they're a little bit more comfortable playing with sort of 30-35% possession than I think they ever were under Emery or Arsene Wenger. They seem to. I mean, I saw City against Brighton at the weekend, and although City won 5-0 and it was quite you know, dominant, there were times when Brighton did them on the counter attack and with a little bit more poise, could have created a chance. And I think Arsenal have a chance on. I mean, it'll have to be a counter attacking game. They'll have to, I think, defend as well as they did in the second half against Liverpool. They'll need a bit of luck to go their way. I think they'll lead City to just be slightly off their level. But I think it's not totally out of the realms of possibility that Arsenal are sort of they showed that if they can sort of play through the initial press, which I think is a big if with you know, the back five that they've got. But if they can play through the initial press, they have the pace and they have the movement on the break that can conceivably hit City in a place where they have been weak in the past.
And the other semi-final is Chelsea versus Manchester United. Chelsea beat Norwich 1-0on Tuesday night. It seems on the pod, one week we're very critical of Chelsea and the next one we're sort of grudgingly congratulatory to Frank Lampard. They are third in the league. Paul, what should I be doing? Should I be what should be the right reaction to how Chelsea are doing?
No, I think you're spot on there to sort of observe that dynamic because I feel it too. I think they are not playing great football and they are vulnerable, and I'm not sure that he's got the. I think the sort of the project element of what was going on at Chelsea at the beginning of the season seems to have been put to the wayside in the bid to make sure that drop the kids, make sure you get into the Champions League. But I've never thought that I'm more impressed with Arteta and Solskjaer in their ability as big former player coaches, their ability to influence games than I have been with Lampard. And they weren't up to much against Norwich, you know. But as has been observed elsewhere, you don't have to be. It's going to be a lot of pressure on Frank next season, I think, to make these big signings be the difference. And to I think there will be an expectation that they challenge for the league title next season. I think that's a big ask right now.
Question from Adam, who says, "This is for Paul. Thoughts about Norwich and Daniel Farke approaching the season with a 5% chance of staying up." That's not a good percentage, even like for Ziggy in Quantum Leap when he presses his buttons saying there's a 5% chance of you staying up. Surely he could have done something different to give them a better chance. Thanks.
Yeah, I think Norwich have blown their restart big time. I think they really thought they had a resolute warrior mentality and, you know, had done the right intermediate season conditioning to get everybody back and fit. But that turned out neither of those things turned out to be the case. And very quickly, just morale plummeted again. I personally speaking, it's been six long years since I've seen us adequately defend a corner. So that would be my because it's not just Farker, it was Alex Neil as well, and that would be my one. Like, come on, guys, just do that. Do it for the fans. Just play a team in one of the last two games. We're down. Just play a team and defend all set pieces adequately. Even like, okay, one, we'll give you one where somebody can sort of miss the runner or it'll skim off the top of their head or they'll try and clear it with their back heel or whatever. But just please, it would be lovely. I would thank you so much.
Are you saying so if Ben Godfrey just heads a corner properly away. Clear, it'll cut to the Zoom Norwich fans cheering wildly. That's the greatest moment of their season. How many players are you worried about not being there next year?
Well, one of the things about being a terrible football team is that over the course of the season, you get less and less worried about losing any of them. You're like, I'm, I am, uh, I, I hope we keep Todd Cantwell, weirdly. I've gone a totally Todd, partly because he's a Norfolk boy, partly because I think he has shown leadership this season in his own performances, but also in after the restart, he's been running the team at times. And this for a kid who a year ago, you know, everybody thought was going to be the one person who wouldn't make the step up. So I've been really impressed with him. I think we'll lose Buendia for sure. I don't think we have that strong a tie with him. And he's recorded 24 goal scoring assist chances or whatever it is. So, you know, I think there'll be people and they can sell him abroad. There's been links with Ben Godfrey in lots of different places, including France and Germany. I think that's interesting. I think he might go. I suspect we might keep the fullbacks. I think Godfrey, Buendia, maybe Cantwell. But the rest, you know, who wants them?
Chelsea play Manchester United in the FA Cup semi-finals Sunday, 6 o'clock. Marcus Rashford has been given an honorary doctorate from the University of Manchester for his amazing work against child poverty, causing that government U-turn and the granting of free food vouchers for the poorest families over the summer. We've talked about how brilliant Rashford is as a bloke and the tremendous things he's done. I always think honorary degrees, though, I'm sort of taking the Barry role on this. I don't have a doctorate because they're bloody hard to get, right? You know, and like you have to spend a lot of time on your own, hours and hours. I just, you know, give people a medal for doing good things, but I don't think you should get a doctorate. Is that, will I get in trouble for that? Like, I love Marcus Rashford. I love what he's done, but there are people with real PhDs who, you know, on really niche subjects, it's really hard to get one. And it's, you know, you have that Viva thing and all that. It sounds so miserable.
Didn't you go to a university where they gave you a free master's?
We had to pay 30 quid for it.
Hey, some of us had to pay bloody $9,000 a year. I've got $60,000 of debt on my head. So yeah. Don't talk about 30 quid for a master's.
Well, although you think I'm old, Flo, I was the first year to pay tuition fees. So.
Oh, boo-hoo. Well, however much that was.
And, Flo, university was much harder in those years. It's got really easy.
Oh, yeah, whatever.
Anyway, well done, Marcus Rashford. we'll look back on the FA Cup semi-finals on Monday's pod. We'll be back in just a second and we'll start at Turf Moor. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Burnley 1, Wolves 1. The excitement here in the 96th minute, the Burnley penalty. Matt Doherty handballing it as Chris Wood attempted to kick him in the face or score an overhead kick, and he tried to defend himself. Dale Johnson, who from ESPN, who is a sort of VAR expert, says, let's be clear on this. There is no way the Burnley penalty is getting overturned by VAR using monitors. The defender's arm was up and out, and the Burnley striker's acrobatic effort in the act was not close enough to the defender. Hashtag Burwall.
I like the optimism, the blind utopian optimism of beginning anything on VAR with, you know, let's be very clear about this. this is the kind of the mess that we've got ourselves into with the handball law, isn't it? It's kind of a theological discussion as much as anything. You know, what we're moving towards legislatively, if that's a word, is any kind of contact on the hand in the penalty area. We're moving towards a stage where any kind of contact with the hand is a penalty. And that opens up whole new kind of tactical dimensions, because if you are an attacking player in a goal scoring position, or you know, you now have every incentive to try and kick the ball, or to try and cross the ball, or to try and nudge the ball against somebody's hand, which I think is kind of what Mane was trying to do against Moussa Sissoko in the Champions League final a couple of years ago. That's going to become a tactical part of the game. You're going to get players who are now being trained not to take evasive action. You're going to have training sessions where someone kicks a ball at their face repeatedly, and they just have to teach themselves not to protect themselves because they're going to give away a penalty. And on the penalty, I mean, it was an amazing penalty. It's like one of the best penalties I've ever seen. Chris Wood.
And the first he scored in the Premier League. I couldn't believe it. I mean,
what? That was his first goal.
Apparently, that was the first penalty he scored in the Premier League. That was what popped up.
He should never take another one.
Yeah.
Just to be clear, the greatest penalty of all time is Kevin Pressman for Sheffield Wednesday against Wolves in the shootout. There's no advances on that, is there, Paul?
Absolutely. I couldn't agree with you more, Max.
Thank you very much. Speaking of great hits, Jimenez's volley was beautiful flow. And I feel he's kind of underrated. I don't know if that's a fair... Oh, Paul has his hand up. It's very polite of you. I can go to you, Paul, if you prefer.
Well, I'm just a big Raul Jimenez stan, that's all. So, I mean, if you want to talk to Flo about it and get some accurate analysis and then come back to me for some gushing.
Perfect. Flo, analysis on Jimenez and then back to Paul just for some love.
I mean, he's a fantastic player. When I was watching back the game, I was kind of more in awe of the hard work that Adama Traore had put in. And he's been fantastic over the last couple of weeks. And I know there's talk of some European clubs, Juventus being one of them, interested in him. I think Adama Traore is more the sort of unsung hero, and Jimenez is the out and out kind of fantastic force that's scored lots of goals for Wolves this season, and I think is more obviously a great player and gets more plaudits. But maybe I'm just too much of a Traore stan, and it will take Paul's Jimenez stan to kind of hit back. I don't know.
Yeah, so I'm a big Adama Traore fan as well, and I think the two in combination with Raul Jimenez, they are a fantastical pairing. But I love Raul because I think he's sort of close to being the epitome of the essential Premier League footballer, in that first and foremost, he's big and strong, never gets knocked off the ball, wins his aerial duels, can fight any centre half. He does his running, does all that work, but then he's also a proper cold-blooded finisher. You know, he always, whenever, you know, it seems to be, you know, half the time it's Traore standing in one up, either to the penalty spot or the back post. He just it's 100% true connection, bish, bash, bosh, done. But he's also got flair, you know, and in that role, that is absolutely something you don't anticipate, you know. That's the real bonus. And you know, he can spin players, he can trick them, he can apply finishes outside the boot, he improvises, and so you know you know what you're going to get with him, and you get a bit more.
And what I think is really nice about him as well is he's so committed to the club and its personality and the local area. I mean, him and his wife went and filmed their kind of gender reveal video at Molineux with all their mates, and I think his wife had to score a penalty in order for something to explode and there was a colour come out. I mean, what footballer would do that?
I think he's probably the best, on current form, the best pure number nine in the Premier League, in a league that actually doesn't have as many as it used to. And there's almost kind of a bit of a snobbishness these days about kind of the old-fashioned centre-forwards. But he's such a clever player as well. But there is kind of because he heads the ball and he scores a lot of near post headers. Yeah, there's a slight snobbishness about that, and that's maybe why he doesn't get his due.
Can you compare him to Harry Kane for me, Johnny? Because Kane scored twice at Newcastle, but again, I don't feel he's on it. And maybe that's the sign of a great centre forward who, you know, does the important thing. His first header was brilliant and the second was really brave. But you talk about the strength of Jimenez and the way he's holding it up. That was a huge part of Harry Kane's game, and it's not there at the moment, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the great thing about Kane was in his heyday, and it's weird talking about a heyday, but I think it's accurate, was that he was kind of two strikers in one. He could drop back to link play. He was great at sort of nudging the ball around the corner or playing a little quick diagonal, releasing Son, releasing Lucas, releasing Dele Alli. And then he could bomb into the box. He wasn't quick, but he was sharp, and he could get in front of his man and score that, you know, score the tap in from 6 yards. And these days he can't do both in the same move. So he drops back and he creates, which he's perfectly good at doing, or he sort of stands up front like a mannequin and, you know, the ball bounces off him. He can't play both of those roles anymore. I don't know whether it's the physical demands. I don't know whether, you know, he's had too many injuries to be able to play those roles, whether he just lacks that sharpness and he needs a whole preseason. But I don't think he's as complete a forward as he was when he was really, really good. And I think that's a big problem. And it kind of lies at the heart of why Tottenham got so bad so quickly, because Kane was at the heart of everything they did defensively as well. He was the guy leading the press. And if you look at him in a big game now, he can't press anymore. He can't press like he used to.
It seems ridiculous, as you say, talking about his heyday. Do you think this is just he had that hamstring injury and it's not quite ready, and next year, whether he's at Spurs or not, he can get that back? I suppose we don't know, do we?
Yeah, it's possible. I mean, he's not been that sort of player for at least a year now. I mean, the injury he got against Manchester City in the Champions League, since then, I don't think he's been that sort of player. So I'd need to see evidence of him, you know, covering the sort of ground that he used to and having the sharpness and the pace that he did 2 or 3 years ago, because he's got, like, I think something like 400 or 500 games under his belt already. And once a striker has played that many games at the sort of intensity that he's been playing at, it's very easy to lose a yard and not quite get it back.
201 career club goals now in 350 appearances. Obviously add internationals to that for the total number of games he's played. Gaz says, according to the BBC, only Liverpool and Manchester City have won more Premier League games than Spurs since Mourinho's first game in November. He says, personally, I had to look that up and check if it was true. Is it time to rethink Jose's impact? I can't believe... he's left me feeling so bereft, and yet he's the third best manager in the league, Paul.
He knows how to win, doesn't he? I mean, and that's always been his philosophy, that it's about winning. You maximise the potential to win, and that quite often means sacrificing. Well, I mean, he has absolutely no affiliation with or tenderness for entertainment. I still think this Spurs team is going to struggle next season. I think, you know, it's not nailed on that they'll get into Europe this, and I think a bid for the Champions League next season could be tough, because I think they are going to have to, you know, continue the regeneration of the team, and there are other projects that are, you know, I think of Arsenal when I'm saying this. There are other projects that look to be heading in the right direction, perhaps even at a quicker pace. So, you know, but there's no doubting, you know, he, as he always reminds us, you know, he's won so many trophies, that doesn't happen by chance.
No, does it?
maybe the first 15, yeah, but I think after that you have to give them some kind of credit.
We should mention Serge Aurier, who decided to play 2 days after the tragic death of his brother Christopher, and as you know, Jose said, look, people grieve in different ways, and he wanted to play, and that takes an amazing strength of character, doesn't it, Flo?
Yeah, definitely. I was surprised to see he was there, and we've seen other players and athletes do the same. And for some people, they feel like it's important to keep some sense of normality and to try and go through kind of the daily motions and act as close to kind of normal as you can. And that is, you know, maybe part of his grieving process. And hopefully when the season does end, he does take some time and is able to see his family and come together, because obviously at this moment, funerals aren't really the same as they were. So if anyone loses someone in this time, it's really difficult. So yeah, extremely brave of him to play on.
We should mention Newcastle, because Matt Ritchie scored an absolutely wonderful, it was a wonderful strike, wasn't it? And Saint-Maximin, who is absolutely it's a joy to watch, isn't he, Paul? He just goes.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, he's him, and for him and Traore to both come on the scene at the same time was sort of spoiled. But I think there's something relentless about Traore, but there's something sort of a bit more, I don't know, expressive, I think, about Saint-Maximin in the way he plays. Both defined by massive pace, but I think the sort of the tricks, the ability to sort of go in the way that you don't anticipate he's going to go, do things, you know, stretch his body, move his body in ways that sort of just catch you entirely by surprise. I think that's what people in the olden days would pay money to go and watch, and now pay a smaller sum of money to stream over a USB stick in the back of their telly.
The thing I love about Saint-Maximin is he shows the defender the ball. He gives the defender a sniff of the ball. It's almost like a, you know, kind of a Victorian circus conjurer or something. He shows you the ball and then he whips it away and then he's gone. And I think that's the main difference between him and Traore. Traore doesn't really care what the defender's doing. He doesn't care how the defender reacts. He's going to get past him however he likes. Whereas Saint-Maximin is like, you like this football? You like this football? a little whip of football. He's gone. So that's the difference between them, I think.
Oh, we should mention the BT Sports Wall. They were doing the Newcastle Spurs game, and I'm amazed. I'm amazed that this hasn't happened yet before. They've decided to, you know, go full Zoom, and they have a, you know, they have sort of like 10 fans or something from each side, and then they're stood next to them and awkwardly ask one of them a question who sort of represents the fans, you know, from their living room. And as yet, everyone has behaved impeccably. But in the top left-hand corner, a Newcastle fan took his shirt off, jumped up and down, and then brought out a banner that said, "Savage is a wanker." And it was just really quite funny. I imagine, you know, some producer had another meeting with someone who booked that fan, and someone may have had their BT Sport disconnected, I don't know. But anyway, it was very funny. Paul?
How deep do you think they go on vetting these candidates? Do you think they put private detectives on them to see, you know, if they've got anything in their past? Because I would have said the chances of somebody doing that were going to be quite high. Somebody's going to stunt at some point.
I don't know, actually. I mean, I'm trying to think how much we vetted the fans of the week in the Soccer AM years. It did make a difference.
It's normally the usual suspects who go on these things.
Is it?
Like, there's always the same sort of people who ring, you know, phone in lines, some who get blocked and get known for, you know, don't pick up the phone to this person, basically. So I think what they would have done is basically, you know, gone for the hardcore who are in the fan clubs. And I think some of them had ulterior motives, shall we say, but it's about time.
On Thursday night, so the games tonight, Everton, Villa, Leicester, Sheffield United, Crystal Palace, Manchester United and Southampton, Brighton. The transfer window will be open for 10 weeks between the 27th of July and the 5th of October. There'll also be a domestic only window between the 5th and 16th of October. Paul?
Basically, it is a small sop from the Premier League to the EFL regarding its imminent collapse through COVID related financial stress. So basically they won't give the EFL any money to prop them up, but they are saying that, which is actually something the EFL agrees with, they want to trade their way out of trouble. And so they've said basically, you know, an extra 10 days. So if a Premier League side can't persuade Lionel Messi to come and sign in the international window, they can turn to Josh Brownlow or whoever, Josh Onnemar in the Championship. Actually, it could be Josh Onnemar could yet be in the Premier League this season. Sorry, Fulham fans. Next season. Sorry, Fulham fans. But yeah, they could go for a replacement in England instead and hopefully drum up more revenue for EFL clubs.
Now, the sub rule, a substitution rule, IFAB has confirmed 5 subs will be extended for next season. Leagues will have the choice whether to use it or not. Inherently feels like a really bad idea to me, Johnny, and weighted in favour of the big clubs. Some people have said, look, it might give a bigger chance for young players or sort of more interesting tactical changes. What are your thoughts?
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, the consensus appears to be that it will favour the biggest clubs with deep squads. But, you know, if you look in the Premier League, most, with the exception of teams like Burnley, most clubs can put out sort of 16 or 17 decent players at any given week. I think what you saw in Rugby Union when they sort of massively kind of embraced the whole replacement culture is that you started getting specialists, what they call starters and finishers, like, you know, Eddie Jones in England talked about starters, and then you'd basically change the entire front row at 50 minutes, 45, 50 minutes, and you would have players whose specific job was to come on late in the game and change it and perform a specific job. And I think we're moving further down that route towards, I guess, you know, rugby union or some of the US sports where you have kind of, you know, finishing pitchers or whatever in baseball, that the role of a late replacement is going to become more specialised.
Before we end part two, you may have noticed in the news that a number of jobs are going at The Guardian. We found out a year or so ago that Football Weekly listeners were the most loyal and also the stingiest. And obviously it's a very difficult time for a lot of people, so we don't expect you to donate all the money you have in the world to us. And there are obviously a lot of very needy causes as well. But if you like the work that The Guardian does, not just for people chatting nonsense about football, but the sort of important stuff it does as well, you can support us. If you go to this link, we get lots of credibility too. We don't get any more money, but we get some credibility. gu.com/footballweeklypod if you feel that you can give us a few quid. Obviously, don't worry if you can't. gu.com/footballweeklypod. As Rob says, Max, I'm now paying for this shit, so keep it half decent. Yeah, we'll do what we can, Rob. And we'll be back in part three where we'll talk about the championship. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, there's a live online show, not an official Guardian event, but me, Barry, Lars and Wilson next Tuesday. Thank you to the two people who tried to tune in this Tuesday and sent tweets going, I can't see this. We weren't on. You were a week early. 8 p.m. start time, £5. You can watch anywhere in the world. If the time doesn't suit you, you can just watch it any time over the next couple of days. You can find details on our Twitter pages. I would say tickets are running out, but since every person with the internet can buy a ticket, there are definitely 7 billion or so tickets still available. So come and watch us, please. Right, the championship. Wigan 8, Hull 0. Wigan 7-0 up at half time. And I don't know if any of you watched the highlights of this game, but they played this goal. Why they're keeping goal music when there are no fans? I mean, why they have it in the first place? But it was just so funny to hear it just going again and again and again. And for the Hull players who were sort of so demoralised, trudging back to the halfway line. Blunderbum says, do you think Wigan Athletic would be disappointed with their second half performance last night? But what a victory for Wigan. And they're now 12 points clear of the relegation zone, Flo. Obviously, their 12-point deduction only hits in if they manage to be more than 12 points above the relegation zone. Their goal difference is better than anyone in the relegation zone. But they've done so amazingly well. And I think everybody wants them to just finish high enough so that they won't go down.
Yeah, they've done so well against all the odds. I mean, it's interesting how many teams in the championship are fighting against, you know, batshit things going on in the boardroom behind them. Hull being another one of those. Lost a good chunk of their team during lockdown for many different reasons, most of them being about contracts. And then obviously there was that whole weirdness about the piece in The Athletic and Hull deciding to publish a whole series of emails that one of the Athletic reporters has sent them. So Hull are in, it's sort of battle who's in a bigger mess, and the messiest seem to be potentially surviving. And that could be Charlton and Wigan end up surviving, with Hull, Barnsley and looks like Luton probably losing out. So it's been such a weird championship season, an amazing season. I think we talked about the Premier League far too long, because some of the games that have been played over the last couple of days in the Premier League haven't really been worth much of a discussion, I think. And there isn't as much to play for. Yes, the relegation places are still up for grabs beyond Norwich going down, and there's, you know, this sort of battle for Europe, but in reality there's not much to play for. Whereas if you look at every single bit of the championship, whether it's the top two, relegation or the playoffs, I mean, there's so much excitement, and I think it's been such a good season for that division. Yeah, at times there's utterly crap football being played, but you could say that at the Premier League too. But you can clearly say, you never have an idea of what's going to happen. 8-0 being part of that. Obviously, administrators trying to sort things out. It's utter chaos, but that team are still fighting hard and pushing for survival. And, you know, I feel really happy for the club and the community it serves that they're giving themselves such a good shot at surviving.
I've read yesterday, I don't know if this is still the case, but there wasn't a single team in the division who was guaranteed to still be in the championship next season. Everybody's either potentially could mathematically get relegated or could mathematically get in the playoffs. I don't know if that's still true, but I mean, it was
at the start of restart. That was definitely true. When we came back from lockdown, there was so much still at stake. Things have kind of evened out a little bit more. Barnsley are dead and buried now, but There's still a lot up for grabs. And when we were coming out of lockdown, that's why it was so important what happened in that, you know, 2-3 month window with some of those teams. Because when we were coming back from restart, there was so much at stake. And teams like QPR have completely fallen apart. Teams like Birmingham have completely fallen apart. West Brom have done pretty badly too. Brentford, unbelievable, won all 7 of their games since restart, really getting themselves within a shot of getting in automatic promotion places. So, yeah, it's, I mean, if anyone has the means to watch the rest of the Championship season, I think, you know, sack off the Premier League, because that's where the real action is.
And you say Barnsley are dead and buried. I mean, they play Leeds tonight, right? I mean, it's a massive game, top v bottom, proper Yorkshire derby. But if they win that, they're 1 point off safety, Barnsley. I mean, I know it's a big if, right?
Yeah, it's a big if. Leeds can blip. And I know I've got some great fans on the podcast who love when I talk about Leeds. But in recent weeks, they've shown a lot of energy. I mean, they're relentless in their style, and obviously with Bielsa at the helm. And of having the lockdown has really helped them, because for a team that's been famous for running out of steam at the end of the season, they basically had 2-3 months to recoup, get all that energy back. And it was basically like starting the season again. So they've come out all guns blazing. They lost to Cardiff, but apart from that, they've been pretty consistent. And I don't see them falling to Barnsley. And Luton have done so well and only lost one game since restart, but they've just drawn too many. And that's why I give them a better shot than Barnsley, but they're still in that bottom three. And Hull, there's just no chance. They're just such a mess.
Yeah, I'm just going to say that's a really good point that Flo makes about the conditioning, and that probably did help. But I think they have managed to find some sort of resolve, 3 wins on the bounce. And I think that Pablo Hernandez winner against Swansea at the weekend had a real feeling of release about it, you know, right into the depths of the game, being well blocked out by a Swansea team, and themselves are in good form. And then just to sort of not only find the winner, but do it with the talismanic player who's driven you this far, and with a beautiful clip finish into the corner. That felt like a release. I mean, Leeds fans know as well as anybody they've got the ability to choke at any point, but they're doing the right things to this point.
And I think it would be great to see Leeds and Brentford go up. I think what Brentford have created there deserves a reward like the Premier League. They have everything mapped out. They've already got their replacement for when Thomas Frank leaves. They're just so smart. They've got the new stadium. I think what they've done, like, it's about time that they were rewarded for that project. So I would really like to see Brentford catch West Brom. And I'd like to see Leeds and Brentford go up. I think that would be great for English football.
You know, like Max, a few days ago, maybe last week, you tweeted, like, what is the club that makes you feel like nothing at all, that you don't love, you don't hate, that you're just totally indifferent to?
Yes, yes. Yeah, complete indifference. Reading got a lot of answers, and Gillingham as well.
Yeah. For me, I think it's West Brom.
Really?
And I don't know. Yeah, sorry to any West Brom fans out there, but the neutral fan should probably be rooting for Brentford to just overhaul them, right?
Yeah, probably. You know, there's the moving to the new stadium and all that. Apologies to Baggies fans. It is true. There are some teams that just, they stir nothing in you. And I don't know what, I feel this with Rotherham. I just don't, there's nothing there, right? And I know that's not fair. And it's because I'm...
And if they don't, you know, if they don't get promoted, it would have been a pretty dismal season for them, because they've got a pretty expensive squad. They lost one of their youngest prospects, Nathan Ferguson, on a free because they couldn't lock him down on a new contract. And they could have cashed in on him big time this summer, but they didn't end up doing it in January. So if they don't get promoted, they lose a massive cash cow. It'll be a pretty disappointing season. And then it's like, right, try and give it another go with all the losses of the pandemic, financial losses, and then this huge squad of which some are on pretty nice juicy pay packets. It's going to be difficult if West Brom don't go up through automatic or the playoffs.
It is Paul Warne who's the manager of Rotherham.
Yeah.
It? Yeah, I like him. So, like, even though that I feel, I just want to give a bit of love back to Rotherham. So who's going to get sick things? It looks, so it's two of Leeds, West Brom and Brentford going straight up. One of them obviously will go into the playoffs. Then Fulham and Forest are in the playoffs pretty much. And then you've got Cardiff, Millwall, Swansea. Cardiff or Millwall would be great stories, wouldn't they?
As would Swansea. You know, they've had their troubles after coming down and had to sort of start again. Lost Graham Potter in the summer, still playing there, still got their football philosophy.
Be interesting if Millwall and Cardiff do make the playoffs, because they're the two, I guess, the Wickham of the Championship, in a sense that they don't play the most glamorous football, if you like, in Cardiff and Millwall being quite known for that in recent years. So them making the playoffs and getting a shot at the Premier League would be would be quite funny. I think if they got promoted, they would really, really struggle next season. And it's kind of, what would you like your club to go through?
Yeah, you've got to get there once, though. You've got to. I mean, it's been so long, especially for Millwall, right? You've got to get there. And you'll have, even if you will just have one or two brilliant results, and you never know. Like, you never know.
I mean, the parachute payments are worth it anyway, and you can just take the hit and not sign anyone and then just, you know, recoup the money that way. But I've always battled with this with QPR as well, because it's like, you know, what's more fun, if you like, getting promoted, but then next season literally losing every single game and it being really boring and painful? I mean, what honestly, which one would you rather take? Would you rather get promoted? And what's worse about this season is you don't even get the fun day at Wembley. And that's the best thing about the playoffs, is win at Wembley. And I've had it with QPR. That's the special day. If you don't even get that, then it's like, well, what's the point in getting promoted than just getting absolutely thumped every weekend?
I don't know. As a Cambridge fan, I would happily be in the Premier League and lose every single game. And I wouldn't care. I'd just be like, we are at Old Trafford and here we are in the Premier. You know,
the novelty wears off pretty much pretty soon. I've done that.
I'd happily see other fans go, oh God, are you serious? Cambridge v Bournemouth on Super Sunday. How boring. I'd be like, yes, it is. And you're going to live through this and it's going to be shit and it's going to be boring. But I don't care. Just a note on Wickham, who were 23rd for every single passing stat against Oxford, being top of every passing stat. I said, I wonder who's 24th. And obviously Berry had gone out of, had been thrown out of the league. And so my apologies. It was my own brain messing that up. Can we talk about James McLean and Arsenal Fan TV, Claude Calegari, who was heard saying DVDs going off as Heung-min Son was substituted during Spurs 2-1 win on Sunday. It got widespread criticism. DVD is a well-known racist slur against Asian people. He's been removed from the channel indefinitely and apologised after he and the channel owner Robbie Lyle attempted to sort of justify the remark with a video. Arsenal Football Club themselves have said, we operate a zero tolerance approach to any form of discrimination. We unreservedly condemn this unacceptable racist behaviour. Our records show the individual involved is not an Arsenal season ticket holder, does not hold any form of ticket membership. James McLean has criticised football authorities and the media over their response to racist and sectarian abuse he's suffered. He praised the support Wilfried Zaha and David McGoldrick have received after being racially abused this week. He said, but what's the difference? I receive and have received more abuse than any other player during my 9 years in England. He's been the victim of online abuse throughout his career, received sectarian taunts from opposition fans over his refusal to wear a poppy. British soldiers shot dead civilian protesters in McLean's home city of Londonderry in 1972 in Bloody Sunday. In a lengthy Facebook post on Monday, he said the lack of support he'd received has left a sour taste in his mouth. And you know, racism isn't a competition. Do you think that James McLean has a point, and the abuse he faces and also the racial abuse of Heung-min Son and other Asian players is viewed differently in some way, or isn't taken as seriously in some way?
It is treated differently. And I think rightly so, because it is different. You can't, I think there's a big debate going on at the moment over the legitimacy or the validity of the term BAME, in that, you know, does that kind of flatten or broad brush what can be quite distinct experiences? You know, the racism that Heung-min Son faces is different from the racism that Wilfried Zaha faces, for example. In the case of James McLean, it's different again. And I think it is good, I think, to be reminded that racism does take many forms, and it affects different groups in different ways, and that while quite rightly the focus over the last few months has been on racism against the black communities, Heung-min Son has been getting DVD shouted at him for years. You know, I think there was a West Ham fan got banned for doing it a couple of years ago, you think about Jamie Vardy, who racially abused an East Asian casino user a few years ago, and was fated as a hero for several years afterwards. Different forms of racism are treated differently, I think, and while that is partly a reflection of, you know, how they are experienced differently,
it is good to be reminded every so often that it does take many different forms.
We've just got time for a couple of questions. On making the VAR chat stop, officials involved with VAR in the A-League, which comes back this week, were told in an email that a decision had been made by A-League chiefs to suspend the use of VAR for the rest of the season. An exciting move for them. It may come back, apparently, for the finals. So, you know, you can have this situation where some terrible decision is missed because there's no VAR, and then they make a terrible mistake in the final. That would be poetic. A question from Tomac. Which Premier League footballer do you think is really cake if you cut them open? Paul?
Zerdan Shaqiri, quite obviously.
Yeah, definitely.
There's a lot of Victoria Sponge in those calves. And Oxo says, I speak without a mouth and hear without ears. I have no body, but I come alive with wind. What am I?
Barry?
Hey, it's as good as answer we've got. Do we want it one more time? I speak without a mouth and hear without ears. I have no body, but I come alive with wind. What am I? I mean, I don't have the answer. I don't know if it's offensive or not, or just a riddle.
Bagpipes?
Maybe it's Does bagpipes sort of have a body, though, don't they?
I guess that sack, the big sack thing.
That's the big sack is the body of bagpipes. Look, we'll go with bagpipes. And if it is like a terribly offensive thing that we didn't understand, here's the apology. if anyone knows the answer, let us know. We'll be back on Monday. Flo, thanks for your time.
Thanks, Max.
Cheers, Johnny.
Cheers, Max.
Thanks, Paul.
Thank you very much, Max.
Speak to you on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.